Greetings, my friends, and welcome to the Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. I'm Paula. It's no small thing to be happy, and we can be happy, according to our guest, Alan Wallace. Look within, says this scholar with degrees in physics, the philosophy of science, and in religious studies. He was also ordained a Buddhist monk. Dr. Wallace works closely with scientists and spiritual leaders intent on bringing Buddhist practices and Western science together to understand better human consciousness. His perspective on what the West has to offer is grounded squarely in the remarkable insights of William James.
William James is one of my heroes, and when he, as one of the great pioneers of psychology in the Western Hemisphere, when he envisioned this fresh new scientific discipline of studying the mind directly by way of introspection, he was not naive. He recognized that's full of potholes and minefields and so forth, but he offered a vision that introspection, the direct observation of one's own mental states, which is exactly one of the things done in meditation, could be actually the spearhead, the central thrust of this great new scientific study of a natural phenomenon, the mind.
Alan Wallace is the author of Genuine Happiness, Meditation as the Path to Fulfillment. He's a longtime practitioner of Buddhism who has taught Buddhist theory and meditation around the world since the mid-1970s. Dr. Wallace's undergraduate degree is from Amherst College. For 14 years, he trained as a Tibetan Buddhist monk and was ordained by His Holiness the Dalai Lama, then earned his doctorate from Stanford. Dr. Wallace now heads the Santa Barbara Institute for Consciousness Studies, which he founded. Bill Russell and I share Dr. Wallace's deep interest in consciousness. We all are hopeful that we are on the verge of a revolution in understanding this aspect of the human experience. We welcomed the opportunity to join in conversation with Dr. Wallace, confident an adventure awaited. Alan Wallace, I found myself today, as I do many days, thinking, this is out of control. Having just read Genuine Happiness and thought along with you in this, the ideas with which I often find myself thinking, that's a delusion, Paula. To start for me in this frenetic world with the idea that I could even consider being in control brought me to what is for me some of the heart of what you want me to know about being alive, isn't it?
You're quite right. You're quite right.
Where did I get this silly notion that somehow I might be in control?
Well, it is a delusion when it comes to the sense of our being in control in terms of other people's behavior, even those closest to us. In fact, I think it's probably a really bad idea.
Including myself closest to us?
Well, certainly in terms of spouses, children, friends, and so forth, the notion of control is simply not part of friendship. It's not part of love. It's not part of very meaningful human relationships. It's learning, it's collaborating, it's sharing. It's not a matter of control. But especially when we go out beyond our immediate environment, out to the economy, to the environment, politics, etc., etc., on an individual level, our degree of control is so marginal that it's almost inevitable that we'll exaggerate it. Then if we're relying for our very happiness, for our well-being, for the sense of flourishing, of satisfaction in life, upon situations, circumstances, people, events that are beyond our control, that's a bad wager. But I feel now that we are on the brink of discovering a new world. We've just had Columbus Day.
Or Indigenous Peoples Day.
Indigenous Peoples Day. I'm happy to rename it anyway because, of course, that continent was very well explored already, but just not by these white guys over in Europe. But the notion of a new world and its fantastic resources is the only thing I'm picking out here. And that to such a small extent, have we really explored our own inner resources for finding a sense of genuine happiness, of depth, of meaning, and so forth, that are not contingent upon external things going our way?
I have been known over and over and over again to say that we live in a time of great change, but as I thought about you, it may be that we live at a time at the beginning of a real revolution.
I certainly hope so. I think if we're not on the brink of a revolution, or another word that's become one of my favorite terms is a new renaissance, if we're not on the brink of a genuine renaissance, then I think we'll simply be following a path that seems that has the outer appearance of humanity being set on its own suicide.
That would be serious.
Well, it seems like there is something of a mania that is dominating so many aspects of public life that simply doesn't even care about our children, our grandchildren, in so many respects. And when a species doesn't care about its own progeny, then that species is writing its tombstone. And that is a situation we're finding here on so many fronts. It's not a little problem here, a little problem there, a little fix-it-up, as the environmentalist said 30 years ago when I was planning on a career, 35 years ago when I was planning on a career in environmental studies. The whole model of cleaning up after the elephant, you know, dump on the environment, dump here, and don't worry, we'll come along and just pick up after you. Well, it was an antiquated notion then, and now it's simply a catastrophic notion.
Happiness. We will come back and talk about happiness. How about that?
Let us talk about that when we come back in just a moment. Please be with us when we return. Welcome back to the Paula Gordon Show. We're delighted to be with Dr. Alan Wallace. Bill Russell, you have that look.
As far as I know, the United States is the only country that has enshrined the notion of happiness in its its founding documents. Mm-hmm. So there's not only the normal human tendency, there's sort of a general cultural, political will to happiness. Mm-hmm. And yet, the circumstances you described sound, and I don't disagree with them, as virtually the embodiment of the antithesis of happiness.
Mm-hmm. Would that be misery?
Is this a failure of understanding, a failure of communication, bad judgment, or are we just sort of lost?
Oh, I think all of the above would be a good place to start.
Yes.
Especially since the rise of modernity, and this is the discovery of the new world, this is the Protestant ethic, this is the rise of modern science, so many of the salient features that launched modernity, which we can no longer call a Western phenomenon, because it's in Tokyo and Beijing and Singapore and Buenos Aires, it is now global. But so many of the salient features that have defined modernity are extroverted. That is, we're looking outwards. We're looking out to the new world. We're looking out to new resources, new places to conquer, new places to enrich ourselves. The Protestant ethic is looking outwards to doing good works, accomplishing a lot in the world. Science, from the time of Copernicus, is looking outwards. It's always looked outwards. This is why it has this ideal of objectivity, not an ideal of sublime subjectivity. When we so get so fixated on the outwards, then we even turn the inwards into the outwards, where we think that human experience, our thoughts, our emotions, our very consciousness itself, if they're real, they too must be something outwards. So we identify them with brain functions. We identify them with behavior. Because if it's not outwards, it must be not existent at all. Now, William James said, "For the moment, what we attend to is reality." One of my favorite quotes. For the moment, what we attend to is reality. And for the last 400 years of moments, modernity has been focusing outwards. Well, if that's where your attention is gazed, fixed, for 400 years, even when it comes to studying the mind, sure, I'll study the mind. I'll study your mind by way of your brain, your behavior, your articulation, your facial expression. When your attention is so fixated on the outward, then when it comes time to find happiness, where do you think you're going to look for it? You have no options. You've got blinkers on, and you're going to look outwards. And of course, we don't find happiness outwards, but we find one heck of a lot of symbols. How big is your bank account? How many credentials do you have after your name? How many buildings do you have named after you? How many people love and respect you? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Some of this sounds like materialism, and materialism is one of the indictments of modern American and Western culture and increasingly the world. But what you're talking about is bigger than materialism. This is much more encompassing. It is in many ways much more dangerous and much harder to deal with.
I think there are a lot of people who fall into this kind of myopia that don't regard themselves as materialists. They may regard themselves as religious fundamentalists and still be as extrospective, as focused on the outwards as anybody else. So yeah, it's much broader than any particular philosophical school or any particular interpretation of science. But now religion has often been condemned, and to a large degree rightly so, for getting caught up in ritual, and then the rituals turn dry, and all you're holding on to for your religion are a bunch of dry husks that used to symbolize something, but now you just have the shell. And so we know this is true. Rituals can be, by definition, I think they can become empty rituals. That's kind of their natural devolution. But religious people are not the only people who fall to that. And I think what we have now are rituals of happiness, symbols of happiness that people cling to, thinking, if I have that, certainly I must be happy, because look, I've got the ritual. Look at my house. Look at my car. And look at my wristwatch. And look at my et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we get caught up in these external symbols, these ritual acts of happiness, and we may not even notice that the one thing that has slipped through our fingers is that for which all those symbols and rituals actually stand, and that is an actual feeling of flourishing, of well-being and happiness.
We characterize ourselves immodestly as Homo sapien. man, the wise. What you're describing would seem to be anything but. This suggests that we are not functionally as clever as perhaps we claim to be, or even, and I think this is your point, as we could be.
I think that's certainly true. I mean, we have the capacity for wisdom, and we have the capacity for virtue. We have the capacity for genuine happiness. Whether we tap into that capacity or get completely fixated on the external trappings of that is an open question. But in this regard in particular, it strikes me that the 20th century presents us with one of the strongest anomalies in human history. Specifically this. It's like the koan for the era. And that is the 20th century displayed, especially, I mean, overwhelmingly through science, the greatest increase in human knowledge and power that the human species had ever seen. I mean, you have a curve going back 10,000, 100,000, 500,000 years, and you see it flat, 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 and then gradually growing, and they get 20th century. And you've got virtually a vertical line there in terms of growth of knowledge and power. That sounds really good. I mean, the more we know, the more we should know how to flourish and be happy and be living in harmony with our environment and getting along with each other and really knowing what makes us truly happy. I mean, we know so much now. And yet, that's one half of the koan. And the other half of the koan is in terms of environmental degradation and man's inhumanity against man. The 20th century trumps all of the preceding centuries with basically no competition. So how is it that we could so wildly and violently degrade our own environment, wipe out so many species, and show such a mind-boggling inhumanity of man against man? How could we do that in the same century in which we know more and we're no more powerful than we've ever been in the past? That is, I think, the anomaly for the 20th century. If we don't solve that one, then our civilization as we know it will not be something that we're looking at in the 22nd century.
It's not just civilization, it's the species.
It's the whole, and unfortunately, and this is when I was going to be an environmentalist when I was in my teens, I thought, well, okay, we humans, we are real screw-ups here. But doggone it, you know, we should only be able to ruin ourselves. We don't have the right. I mean, if I'm living in a home, if I want to trash my home, well, okay, I'm really a fool, but that's kind of like, okay, well, it's your home. But it's really quite not fair, to use a silly old-fashioned term. It's just not quite fair that we could so butcher the environment that it's not only the human species and human civilization that suffers, but basically all the species down to maybe microbes are going to be experiencing the brunt of our stupidity, our greed. We have to be more responsible than that.
Do you regularly talk, almost as an historian of science, you talk about hypotheses. As you look at these twin, the koan, as you would, do you have a hypothesis of how we proceed to get out of this pretty dark place?
Sure. If we don't have hypotheses, then we're stuck in repeating the past. So I think what we really need here is vision. We don't need necessarily more of an information glut, but we do need to have a renaissance of wisdom. And I think we really are in dire and urgent need of a renaissance. But we can take inspiration from the last great renaissance, the 15th century, the 16th century, this great birth of modernity, which is, of course, has tremendous advantages, great successes, discoveries, boons, modern medicine being one of many. But if we look for the catalysts, there was a profound challenging of authority that had been largely unquestioned for centuries because it seemed on one level to work so well. That's one thing we need. But now it's not a challenging the authority of a church. It's not challenging the authority of the Greeks. It's challenging the authority that is, for example, expounded by our major universities and our governments and other institutions of power, business, and so forth.
Which are all linked.
They're all profoundly interlinked. They're all fueling each other. To be challenging the authority there, the mainstream, the status quo, the received wisdom, a challenging of that. But that's not enough. That could lead to just anarchy. But in addition to that, to draw inspiration from earlier civilizations that in some respects really had their act together and in some ways had their act together much better than we do now. So in the 16th century, the 15th century, 16th century, they were drawing inspiration from the Arabic culture, which had, you know, had its golden era, which was very, very bright. They were drawing inspiration from the Greeks, unearthing manuscripts and so forth they had not known about for centuries. And so they were tapping into the wisdom of the Mediterranean basin, and that catalyzed fresh ideas. Well, now, happily, with our transportation, with our communication, we can now tap into the wisdom of the world. We're not confined to the Mediterranean basin anymore. This very famous statement by Einstein, the mind that creates the problem is not the mind to solve the problem. I'm paraphrasing, of course. We better look outside of our boxes and recognize there have been other great civilizations on this planet that are equally old or older than our own. And they have their own wisdom. And in evaluating it, we have to evaluate it all afresh and not simply evaluate it in terms of, have you gotten as far as we have?
Or have you come to the same conclusions we have, which will make you right?
Precisely. Yeah.
We have the pleasure to be with Alan Wallace here on the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I invite you to return when we all three come back in just a moment. Dr. Alan Wallace is with us here on the Paula Gordon Show. I have often thought, and have for most of my life, what would it be like to be a human before agriculture, before all the things that have sort of set us on this course? To go back and say, what were we when we were our most essential physicalness in the world? When we were still just hunter-gatherers and had been for a long time and anatomically human for however many years one chooses to count. In a way, as I read Genuine Happiness, I wondered if you weren't offering me a path to know what kind of a creature I am.
I hope so.
And that's not really a distant question from where you just were. It seems that that might be that there might be people in the world who have thought long and hard about these things to understand what I really am rather than all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if perhaps you were giving me some handles.
Well, drawing in the various books that I've done, drawing from, of course, not only my own musings, my own reflections, but really trying to tap as deeply as I can into some of these wisdom traditions of the world. And of course, the area that I've specialized in is the Buddhist tradition from India, from Tibet. I think it was more than there being great philosophers. Again, that's a way to cast them in a way in our own image. They were more than philosophers, and they were more than theologians. They were also, at the best of times, empiricists.
Empiricists?
Empiricists. But now when we say, and this goes right back to an earlier theme, when we say empiricism, we mean looking outwards. We think of empiricism as what you can see with the five physical senses and then those augmented by and refined with the instruments of technology. And that's what's really empirical, that which is objective, prone to third person, corroboration, and so forth. Well, that's a very limited notion of empiricism. We have a sixth door of perception. We don't even have a word for it in modern psychology, except for one that has basically been marginalized for more than 100 years, and that is introspection. But there's a whole world of experience here, a domain of reality, which consists of mental phenomena. This wide range, this wide swath of mental phenomena, of mental imagery and desires, memories, beliefs, states of consciousness. And it's, to a very large extent, it remains unexplored from a first-person perspective. And so we have excelled in our modern civilization at the third-person and the extrospective. But there is this complementary orientation. And the Greeks knew about it. They had a term that we no longer have. In fact, they had quite a few terms. Eudaimonia is one of them. Genuine happiness, flourishing. We don't really have a word for that. We just have to make up one. But they had a very deep sense. Aristotle did. And they had another term called noitos. Noitos. And that is a direct mode of perception of non-sensual or non-sensory, non-physical phenomena. But the notion that there's another mode of perception. Well, that too, if it's direct perception, direct observation, we should call that empirical. But this is where the great cultures of, number one, ancient Greece, the Pythagoreans, for example, Pythagoreans, the Chinese, the Greeks, the Indians, the Tibetans, they, I am persuaded, had developed over centuries extremely refined means of empirical observation of states of consciousness and exploring deeper and deeper states of consciousness that lie basically over the horizon of modern psychology. Because modern psychology, the cognitive sciences on a whole, have focused almost exclusively on normal people, mentally ill people, and brain-damaged people. And then we've defined the human psyche as if normal is as good as it gets. We as a culture are suffering from what I would call an imagination deficit disorder. What about extraordinary people? Not only people who have extraordinary talents and skills, but people who have extraordinary hearts, extraordinary minds, extraordinary states of consciousness. When shall we study these people? Better yet, when shall we become such people?
Listening to you, thinking, oddly enough, of Bertrand Russell, who defined more or less modern logic, great intellect, some people like him better than others, Lord Russell. And at some point in his career, he was also a philosopher, said that the only logically consistent view of the world is solipsism, which in a way is a curious variant on what you just said.
Not everybody is familiar with solipsism.
The belief that only I exist and everything else is just a projection, a creation of my own imagination. And the reason, of course, is that's the only immediate access you have is to your own feelings. Now, you got Bertrand Russell on the one hand defining modern logic, and who argues that this is the only logical way, you know, logically consistent, the most logically consistent way to see the world. And then you've got all this other stuff that you're talking about, and it seems to me that Uncle Bertie comes down on your side.
Uncle Bertie being Bertrand Russell, in case you missed that.
Uncle Bertie, I'm not quite sure I want him in the same bed with me. Maybe in the same bedroom we can talk.
Well, you'd have to be careful. He was a bit of a rounder.
So I understand, yes. So, yes, I'd be happy to chat with him over the dinner table. Solipsism, of course, I think he must have been saying that somewhat with tongue-in-cheek.
Well, he was provocative. I mean, that was...
And that's a good thing to be. That's a good thing to be. But number one, when I consider that I had my mother, that I have a mother, actually, I'm happy to say she's still alive, for me to think that she's a figment of my imagination becomes rather problematic logically. Thanks, Mom. You're keeping me grounded here.
Absolutely.
But there is something of who is the handmaiden of whom. And to a certain extent, modernity has made immediate experience the handmaiden of reason. And that is, science is has been seeking from the time of Copernicus to understand the objective world as it would appear from God's own perspective, absolutely beyond the veil of appearances, in other words, absolutely beyond anything that immediately appears to our senses. What would the universe look like if you were God and had an absolutely perfect objective perspective? Now, that what kind of phrasing, of course, is antiquated since the 19th century. Now, the philosopher Thomas Nagel calls it a view from nowhere. But imagine you were no one and nobody viewing from nowhere. What would the universe look like then?
Which is also essentially Platonic.
Well, it can be interpreted in that way, but...
But I don't mean to distract you. I'm sorry.
But right. But what they're getting at here is that, and this has been a theme of science for the last 400 years, that the way we're going to get to what's really there beyond appearances and independent of appearances is not going to be just by gazing at appearance more closely, but in fact having appearances be the handmaiden of reason. So who has ever actually seen an electron, a photon? Who has ever seen a gravitational field or an electromagnetic wave? Who has ever seen an electric charge, or let alone a black hole, and so forth? So these are conceptual constructs that scientists, true believers, are believing these concepts really do reflect what's out there, independent of all appearances. So this is one way of having the empirical data be a handmaiden for conceptual constructs, which would be, in the old jargon, conceptual constructs corresponding to what God himself would see. Now, in these more contemplative cultures, like Taoism, like Buddhism, like the Vedanta tradition in Hinduism, and so on, reason is a handmaiden of experience. And this was the case for the Neoplatonics, John Scotus Eriugen in the 8th century, Nicholas of Cusa, one of my heroes, in the 15th century, challenging the authority, the scholasticism of the Aristotelian current going through Thomas Aquinas, and coming back to the immediacy of experience, but beyond any kind of mundane experience, and crucially, beyond reason. That reason, concepts, the intellect, in the modern sense of the term, all of these are handmaidens for the profound transformation of immediate experience, rather than having immediate experience be the handmaiden for developing more and more elegant theories. I think this is part of the imbalance that we're witnessing in the 20th century. Elegant theories, not much in the way of transcendence of immediate experience and the way we are as ethical and potentially compassionate and happy and wise people.
You talk a lot about balance as a really foundational notion. When you talk about it in what sounds a little abstract, as the two of you are visiting the Western tradition of philosophical pursuit and then saying, and there's another way to say it, that alone would offer us some opportunities for some balance in the current time, to not be trapped right by that. When I was in college, we really didn't have access to the Eastern traditions in ways that just plain old college kids could grasp. Mm-hmm. You, a little younger than I, took off and went to really study this stuff. You went to the source.
Yeah.
And you didn't do it just because you were a rock and roller. Having access to these big notions coming out of deeply, very old and deeply reflective traditions gives us more tools to be thinking about these things, including balance, does it not?
I think you've really put your finger on it. Balance is indeed the key. And this is exactly the problem with modernity, is that for all of our excellences, and I'm not against modernity, I don't want to be walking across the country. I just flew from California to Georgia. It would have been a really long walk, you know? So I'm very happy to embrace many aspects of modernity, many aspects of science, modern medicine, and so forth. But we've lost balance. We've lost balance. And so when I envision hypotheses, to use the term you used earlier, when I envision how could we flourish, we as a species, in interrelationship with the rest of the species with whom we share this planet and the environment as a whole, I'm not thinking of returning to some Rousseauian ideal of the noble savage, let us go back and all be hunter-gatherers. I mean, it's not an option, for one thing. And there's no way on Earth that this planet, literally on Earth, that this planet would support 6 or 7 billion people as hunter-gatherers. That's not going to happen. But what I do see as a renaissance, a possibly unprecedented fusion or integration, would be able to maintain the strengths, the beauty, the depth, the acuity of modernity, including modern science and so forth, but tap into our deep wisdom cultures of the East and the West, and bring about an unprecedented infusion. Because I'm not just a traditional Buddhist that's wishing I was in the 13th century and wanting just to have that Buddhist worldview without any relevance to modern science. That's not an option for me. I'm either, in terms of Buddhism, I'm either a neo-Buddhist or no Buddhist at all.
But you are Alan Wallace, or at least you give the illusion of being Alan Wallace, who is with us here on the Paula Gordon Show. We hope that you'll be with us.
The manifestations.
Indeed. Yeah. We'll be back shortly. Be with us. This is the Paula Gordon Show, conversations with people at the leading edge. One of those people is Alan Wallace. Genuine happiness is specifically what brought us together. Meditation as the path to fulfillment, not enlightenment, fulfillment. maybe enlightenment's in there too. You talk about, well, you know, I'm not sure about where I am in the Buddhist tradition. You're very Western, as well as having experienced the Buddhist tradition. And Bill, you want to carry that forward? Well,
we think of Buddhism, I think, if we think of it at all, as one of the great religions of the world. You know, like Christianity and Islam and Judaism and Hinduism, and, you know, another one of the great religions. Which, of course, means that we use our ideas of what religion are to describe or to think about, to conceive of Buddhism.
Or dismiss.
Or dismiss, more to the point. But my guess is, based on what you've said, that there may be more differences than similarities. That it may be, when we say religion, what we mean and what a Buddhist would mean by religion or philosophy or science. In this globalization you talk about, it seems that we need to begin to understand that these concepts are also culture dependent.
This is certainly true. Words never define themselves. Words are always defined within the context of a time and place, cultures that themselves evolve. When Western academia encountered such non-Western or non-Mediterranean-based knowledge traditions, traditions of faith, and so forth, I think the boxes that were already in place, psychology, philosophy, anthropology, history, and so forth, the boxes of our departments were already in place, and then something like Buddhism comes in, and it's like a marble rolling around it. What is Chinese checkers? Waiting, which you're going to fall into one of these holes. It's just a matter of which hole you. And but that hole was prefabricated before this marble ever came in.
I think of it as roulette.
Maybe.
Well, of course, I think the authentic response to this. I think there is an authentic response. I'm going to be really bold here, and that is that. Traditions such as Taoism, the many schools of Hinduism, and the various schools of Buddhism simply do not fit in the Mediterranean boxes that we have devised based upon our own unique heritage, drawing from the Judeo-Christian and the Greco-Roman. I mean, those are two broad strokes, but those two define Western civilization, that we have been a fusion for a very long time, for 2,000 years, of the Greco-Roman on the one hand, which is a civilization all by itself, and the Judeo-Christian, which is a civilization all by itself, and we are an alloy of those two. And out of that alloy, we have defined, and it's we in Europe, and now all civilizations influenced by Europe, we have defined in our own likeness what we mean by religion. I think, strictly speaking, there are three religions on the planet: Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Those are the three traditions that, on the basis of which we have defined the term religion, and then we wander over to Tibet or India or Sri Lanka or Thailand, we say, there are bald-headed men wearing robes, and they have incense, and they have rosary. They must be religious. Oh, they are bowing. They are worshiping. Oh, they must be religious. But then we see them out in the debating courtyard, if you get that far, and say, no, they must be philosophers. Then we see them meditating and engaging in very, if we could see what they're actually doing, and engaging in very, very sophisticated, rigorous investigations, empirical observations of mental states, and we could say, I get it, you're an internal scientist. But the point is not that Buddhism or Hinduism, Taoism, and so forth are science, or they are philosophy, or they are religion, but rather they are not us. And they deserve to be defined, which is to say, really, to be understood and appreciated in their own terms, and not engage in this type of ideological hegemony or imperialism of saying, if you're worth anything, you will fit into one of our boxes. So when Buddhism confronted or encountered modern academics, they couldn't put it in science. They couldn't put it in history. It wasn't really quite up to snuff for philosophy, because it had practice and it had faith. So they put it in the little bin, which nobody else wanted. Religion.
You have a PhD.
In which, yes, I decided to go for the runt of the litter. But it's an anomaly, because our modern universities stand for rationality, for the secular worldview, everything to be put to the test of reason and empirical evidence, empirical, of course, being objective. In which case, I think people in the academic departments of religion feel rather ill at ease. Because what are you studying superstition for? Why would you want to bring your rationality to the study of superstition? Well, I think they're struggling with that ever since secular academic departments of religious studies were founded. Because before then, you had theological departments.
The struggle. One of the interesting things about your representation of Buddhism, the trees that have given their lives for arguments about between science and religion in the West, it is an ongoing argument. It is a vicious argument in various parts of the world, in this country not excluded. And you are talking about an entity that we tend to characterize as religion, where that conflict seems not to exist, and in fact, it seems to integrate a scientific perspective with a religious, what to us would be a religious perspective, with a philosophical perspective. So that integration, for those of us who are, you know, have been fighting for pretty much millennia, too. These science versus religion, and certainly since Copernicus, it would seem that view, given the conflicts and the almost irreconcilable conflicts that we're faced with in the West between our religions, those three religions you mentioned, the Mediterranean religions, and science, that it would serve us well to look at avail ourselves of this different perspective that allows a large number of people to essentially bypass, or at least bypass that conflict, or resolve it in a way that is fresh and new and different to us.
Is that the revolution?
The revolution, the Renaissance, I think, may be sparked in part by Buddhism. I don't want to exaggerate that, because that's a tradition which I myself, of course, am strongly affiliated, but also really tapping into wisdom cultures all over the planet and recognizing there's no one group, no one institution or worldview that has all the answers. But these points you're raising here, I would have to say, first of all, as a person who's been very much involved in Buddhist tradition now for 35 years, you don't have to look very far to find very dogmatic people in the Buddhist fold. I mean, there are Buddhist fundamentalists, as there are Christian and Muslim, and frankly, as there are also people of exactly the same mindset in modern science. And their detractors call them advocates of scientism. That it's basically the one true faith all over again. The one true faith. Science has all the answers. If you're not doing science, then it's posh, you know. You don't have any answers at all. You're just caught up in faith-based whatever. But looking outside of our own basin, and it's a good metaphor, looking outside of our own basin, I think is a really good place to start and look with fresh eyes, raising even the question that Carl Sagan brought to our attention very publicly, is there intelligent life elsewhere in the universe? And I think the answer is yes, and it's on our planet. But we may not recognize it because they don't look much like us. And insofar as they don't look like us, it looks like they don't know anything. And they just have faith and belief.
This is parochialism. I mean, in some ways, what you're describing, and I really want to get to the relationship between science and Buddhism and the sixth sense, mm-hmm. as a scientific methodology. The conflicts seem to be predicated on a parochial view that we simply will not let go of, because it doesn't work, but it's familiar. I mean, it seems almost that simple. You know, that's the way we've always done it, and we'll continue to do it that way, even if it doesn't work, which is, you know, a one definition of madness.
One more instance of an imagination deficit disorder. One understands that's parochialism. Such ethnocentricity when it took place 3,000 years ago, when China thought that it was really the center of civilization for the whole planet, when the Greeks had the same idea, when the Jews regarded themselves uniquely as the chosen people of God, the creator of the whole universe. It's understandable back then. You don't know any better. But nowadays,
no new data available.
No new data. You don't speak their language. They live far away. You hardly ever bump into them. They look different. They look funny. They must be barbarian. And so, but this is old hat. This has been going on for centuries. And one can understand that, you know, 1,000 years ago and even 500 years ago. But now, when we're still living as if, as if, you know, nobody had gone beyond, let's say, a horse to get from one place to another, with the kind of transportation and communication and the number of translations that we have from all of the major languages of the planet, and of texts, of literature going back 3,000 years, at this point, and these are at the touch of a keyboard, you know, with being able to purchase books, at this point, to have that kind of parochialism, we should be embarrassed.
Well, you're talking about willful parochialism.
It is willful. I was debating with more than a year ago a very, very prominent philosopher. I think I will protect his name. But this whole issue that you just raised about there being a sixth sense, and a sixth sense not with a Twilight Zone, you know, theme music and playing in the background, not that one, but just we can observe states of consciousness. It is possible to become lucid in the dream state and to observe the events in the dream as if you are awake, knowing that you're dreaming and knowing that everything you experience consists of nothing other than configurations of consciousness. That's one prime instance of this noetos, of this what Buddhists call mental perception, a sixth mode of perception. But we don't need to fall asleep first. That's just when the theater is open, especially. But during the waking state, we can cultivate and refine that ability to observe mental phenomena, and it opens up a whole realm of science that we've hardly touched, both for knowing but also for tapping into where we started from, and that is what are our internal resources that could give us a sense of flourishing, not only in times of felicity, when things are going swell, but in times of cataclysm, of personal disaster, environmental disaster. Can we possibly flourish even when the outer circumstances are really going down?
In 20 seconds or fewer, I will give that philosopher his moment as well. What? How in the world did he object to that?
Well, I mentioned this anonymous philosopher, number one, because I found his mind hermetically sealed. But when it came to even raising this, considering this position, and this was a philosopher of mine, by the way, this possibility of actually developing a refined ability to observe mental states, his reference to all of Buddhist meditation was, well, if you people want to stare at your navels, that's fine by me. And this man is at a very, very major institution. And when he said that, it was kind of like my jaw dropped and my eyes bugged out. People are still saying that? People are still saying that? I was frankly astonished that anybody who's even literate could make such an extraordinarily foolish statement. And this man is not a fool. And that's the enigma. The man is not a fool. He's extremely knowledgeable, very erudite. But there's a willful ethnocentricity there and a willful refusal to look outside of his own box. I found that quite astonishing and quite troubling, actually.
That's his 20 seconds. We'll be back with Alan Wallace and find better ways to go exploring, unseal some of those hermetically sealed boxes when we return in just a moment. Please be with us. Alan Wallace, Dr. Alan Wallace, is our guest here on the Paula Gordon Show. You do have the Santa Barbara Institute for the Study. All right, you say it.
I have established the Santa Barbara Institute for Consciousness Studies.
All right. Both ways, one is studying consciousness.
One hopes so.
And you are doing that in all kinds of interesting ways, including going out into the academic places and debating and thinking and working with anybody who will work with you, and apparently there are people who will not work with you, it appears. This notion that we know some things and we can really do some things. Yes, there are those laggards, but then you also smile and get up and go forward. Some of that going forward isn't arcane at all. It's something I can do going to sleep. It's something that people can do of which each and every one of us actually could have our own lives better and thereby perhaps let there be peace in the world and let it begin with me.
Sure, sure.
Without being new agey at all.
Sure.
You have addressed some of that as you think about meditation. Is that the bus to catch?
I think if we understand meditation in a broad and non-dogmatic way, the answer is yes. But meditation often has a rather esoteric, occult, and trendy quality to it. Oh, I'm going to meditate now. Like, instead of getting massage, you know, instead of going out and sitting in the sauna for a little while, or the jacuzzi, I think I'm not going to have the jacuzzi. I'll go for a meditation session instead. And so it can be very cute and very trivial. But if we go back to the great contemplative traditions of the world, of which happily we have quite a few, I can cite just one that I think has an exceptional richness, and that is the whole Indian-based matrix of meditative traditions. And in Sanskrit, one of the primary terms for meditation is called bhavana, and it just means to cultivate, to cultivate. So is cultivation of the heart, the mind, cultivating our way of being present with the world and engaging with the world, could cultivation be the key to finding fulfillment, to waking up and being more vividly, lucidly engaged with the reality that we are and the reality that surrounds us? Yes, then meditation is the key.
And then the Buddha, the historical Buddha, comes along and says, yes, and. What is that yes, and?
This requires, in the bigger picture, a commitment without parallel. Talking about a revolution, talk about a renaissance. It's not something that I want to impose on somebody else. This revolution, this renaissance, it starts internally, or it's a sham. We know about revolution, political revolutions, where you come and you topple one awful regime, and after only 20, 30 years, you have the awful regime, and other people are trying to topple you, and it's on and on, one outer revolution after another. But this type of revolution calls for a radical reorientation of our way of life, that there are guiding stars. I think the guiding star of nonviolence, that we don't do violence to ourselves, to other people, to other species, to the environment. And where possible, we are of service. We really cultivate the seeds of happiness and well-being in ourselves, other people, other species, and the environment. It's called ethics. And we've cited that largely with religion. It's time to overcome that one more imbalance. Leaving science with all of its knowledge and power, science and technology, virtually devoid of ethics, is one of the catastrophes of the 20th century. Keeping religion over here, this foolish notion of non-overlapping magisteria, that keep religion over here in its side of the ring and don't let it touch science, keep science over here in its side of the ring, don't let it touch religion. Well, we tried that the 20th century. By the way, that came out a disaster. And so religion must be informed. It must have the eyes of science, of empirical knowledge. And science must be informed by ethics, by ideals. It's always been value-laden. Science has never, ever in its history been value-free. That is a myth. And so meditation entails ethics as its foundation, a radical reorientation of our way of being present in the world and engaging, and upon the basis of that, cultivating the heart and mind to develop exceptional states of mental balance, psychological well-being, eudaimonia. And upon the basis of that, there may be a possibility of what the great contemplatives throughout history have been talking about for millennia, and that is genuine transcendence. But all in good time. Ethics, then the cultivation of the heart and mind, and finally transcendence.
That action element, that as I understood what you said of the historical Buddha, that he understood that contemplative, and it had to have action to go the next step.
These are the two wings. As the metaphor is, a bird can't fly with one wing. And the two wings by which Buddhism has taken flight, when it has flown well over the last 2,500 years, are called wisdom and skillful means. And the very essence of skillful means is compassion. But skillful means all the doing that we do, all the engaging that we engage, hopefully, ideally, motivated, aroused, inspired by compassion, by caring. There's a more fundamental term. The Dalai Lama loves to bring this one out. There's a term more fundamental than love or loving kindness, more fundamental than compassion. And that is caring, a heartfelt caring. That if this inspires, that I truly do care about myself, not in a self-centered or narcissistic fashion, but I care about this human being and I want this human being to flourish. That's not a bad thing. But as soon as I affirm that, then I recognize, well, right now, my presence is not independent of your presence. I'm arising from moment to moment. Bill is arising from moment to moment. We're a triad here, and that's just in the small container. And that we are rising and rising from moment to moment together. So the notion that somehow I could flourish independently of you and independently of my environment is a fool's errand.
Alan Wallace, we'll be back in a moment. It is our great pleasure to be with Dr. Alan Wallace, Bill Russell, and I, Paula. I really like being able to get up in the morning and smile to myself and say, this is going to be a good day. I don't know what I'm going to do with it, but this is going to be a good day. There'll be some obstacles. How do you, when you are working with people, give them that sense of, this is going to be a good day? How does one embody that notion of being positive instead of negative? Let's see. Let the species might go extinct, or?
For the moment, what we attend to is reality. I'll come back to William James's koan. If we get mired down in all of the dire warnings, the tragedies, the disasters, the pending disasters, then that will simply pull us down. And it may actually stifle our imagination, our vision. So without being foolish in the sense of ignoring the problems that are there, where my heart gravitates, where my mind gravitates, my imagination gravitates, is what are the possibilities? What is a vision of my own flourishing? Regardless of whatever impact I can have on the world or however the world turns out, can I envision flourishing in a world that is so much beyond my control? And my answer is yes, I can. And so sharing that, I do love engaging with people, and I do so almost in a homogeneous way, especially in terms of public activities. The material that I discuss, I love, and it inspires me and fills me with joy. And when I engage with other people who are open, interested, that love just flows out. And so when I'm with people that I feel deeply connected with, where love, affection, a sense of caring flows unimpededly, and I'm talking about things that I love, that inspire, that's easy. All goes well.
What is hard is when all does not go well. How do we speak to our young people to give them a sense of hope? Or is that too confining a word, hope?
We do need hope. Of course we need hope. It goes hand in hand with vision and possibilities. And frankly, in my engagement with young people, especially during 4 years when I was teaching many undergraduate courses at the University of California, Santa Barbara, I found that they didn't need much prodding. They were not yet in the ruts. They were not yet entrenched in trying to establish themselves as being this as opposed to that, and climbing some pre-established ladder at the top of which there was going to be some symbol of success.
Not success itself.
No, a symbol of success. Grab onto that and close your eyes and hope it's good. No, I found so many young people, and I continue to do so, because I still engage a lot in conferences, in seminars, in meditation retreats, and so forth. I meet with young people a lot, and frankly, I find them inspiring. That so many of these bright young people in their 20s, their early 30s, even late teens, they're as intelligent as anybody else. You don't get more intelligent as you get older. They don't have the experience yet. But I sense a light in their eyes and a willingness to open up and to explore things that even my generation has not explored, let alone past generations. I think there's a lot of hope there. And so what can we offer them? Options. Options and more options. Let them find their own way, but provide them with alternatives. Provide them with unexplored territories, a new world of engaging with ancient worlds in a fresh and unprecedented way. Let them engage and explore in the inner world of their own internal resources and tap into those in ways that they've never seen before. Provide them with the opportunity for inspiration, and they will leap to it.
I want to go one other place, and this has to do with credibility. To me, I'm like a lot of people who was trained in the West and, you know, in the sciences and in the skepticism and all that go with that. And I had not, until reading and your work and listening to you, it had not occurred to me that meditation could be a research agenda. more substantively that it could be a scientific research agenda. It's easy to make general statements. We tend to credit, from a skeptical standpoint, those things that get embossed with science. And the notion that what the meditation tradition, the traditions coming out of the East, could in fact lead us to a bright, new, shiny way of doing substantive and important scientific research, to me, was extraordinary.
I'd be willing to dedicate most of the rest of my life to that vision right there. William James is one of my heroes, and when he, as one of the great pioneers of psychology in the Western Hemisphere, when he envisioned this fresh new scientific discipline of studying the mind, he envisioned a triadic approach, studying the mind indirectly by way of its behavioral expressions, studying the mind indirectly by studying its neural causes, and first, foremost, and always, studying the mind directly by way of introspection. And he was not naive. He recognized that's full of potholes and minefields and so forth, but he offered a vision that introspection, the direct observation of one's own mental states, which is exactly one of the things done in meditation, could be actually the spearhead, the central thrust of this great new scientific study of a natural phenomenon, the mind. We've done tremendous work. We, that is, scientists, have done tremendous work studying the mind by way of behavior, tremendous work more and more by studying the mind indirectly by way of the brain. We've made virtually no progress since time of William James, of studying the mind directly by means of immediate observation, introspection, meditation. Maybe the time is ripe now, that we don't have to reinvent that wheel. We don't have to do this as if nobody's else never thought of this before, but tap into these great contemplative traditions, such as Buddhism, provide the missing link, and give some depth to this notion of what it means to be human and the very nature of consciousness itself.
And that will be a revolution.
Truly a revolution, hopefully a true renaissance.
We thank you, Alan Wallace.
You're welcome, Paula, and to you both.
Alan Wallace has done us all an immense service in writing Genuine Happiness, Meditation as the Path to Fulfillment, and his other stimulating and enlightening books. We thank him for giving all of us access to authentic, genuine happiness. We also thank the Loesling Institute and our mutual friend, the remarkable Dr. Paul Ekman, for bringing us all together. I'm Paula Gordon. I wish you well.